in the depths of space. In fact, he had even created himself a very primitive cave dwelling within a large asteroid. From what I had seen of the malfunctions that came with this severity of karma, it was no surprise that he didn't have anything more advanced than a bioluminescent bulb for lighting. I gave a small sigh, shaking my head at the realization that this wouldn't be done for quite some time. He would need a stroke of luck to get his new energy working, but his luck was currently so bad that I didn't know how that would be possible. The worst part was that there was essentially nothing that I could do to help without causing myself and the rest of the world to be influenced by that same secondary karma that the lab had been dealing with. James sat on his stone stool, staring at the empty wall of his cave. In his vision, dozens of different formulas were being projected, shifting and correcting themselves every second. What was it? His brows furrowed as he thought to himself, trying to catch that epiphany again. In truth, there had been nearly a dozen times over the last 3 years when he had nearly resolved his crisis. He would be just on the verge of finalizing his thoughts on how to create the energy that he needed when something struck and forced him off his train of thought. Perhaps it was a collision with another asteroid, or a monster god appeared, drawn to his power. Luck isn't absolute. Any degree of luck can be overcome by the same level of intelligence. This was the thought James had when he first entered his isolation. Unfortunately, he underestimated just how much intelligence would be needed to overcome this degree of negative luck. He already had the ability to view the weave of fate, and had been able to do so for more than a century. The problem was how he could alter this fate weave, cutting off his bad fortune from the root. What was it? I thought that I had to combine the one light and the fate window, but what else was there? James could already feel a sensation of danger approaching as his thoughts got to this point, but he wasn't going to let himself stop now. He triggered the recording process of the scholar class and sent out an avatar of himself to handle whatever dangers may be coming. He needed this breakthrough. This was the major step that he would have to take before he was able to solve his karma. Outside of the asteroid, a cloud of mist began to flow over, with a silver sphere at its core. When the avatar saw this, it immediately identified it as one of the few spacefaring slimes, the void gas slime. The avatar flew forward, creating a barrier between itself and the asteroid behind it, and prepared for a bitter battle. At the very least, it's not a god yet. Inside the cave, James had cut his thoughts off from those of his avatar, not allowing himself to be distracted at this crucial moment. Were there other energies that I needed to combine? If it wasn't just one light and fate window, what else would cover what's missing? Outside, the avatar had grown by more than 100 meters, directly controlling the power of space to push back whenever a piece of the slime made its way over. Its eyes were on the slime's core, thinking how it could destroy it without causing any ripples that would affect the asteroid behind him. Unfortunately, the power of space couldn't penetrate the void gas slime, nor could any other disconnected energy. As shown from its name, the slime's body partially exists within the void, and the essence of the void leaks over, devouring any energy that enters its body. Record, James thought to himself, as he stood within the asteroid, eyes shining. He had to make sure that this moment was saved in his mind. The Eye of Ruin has to be used. The moment that thought occurred to him, the asteroid shook, almost causing him to stumble. However, that didn't matter anymore. An almost manic grin plastered across his face. His real body flew out of the asteroid, absorbing the strength of his avatar. When he saw the slime in the distance, he held his hand out. In fact, there was an easy way for the avatar to deal with this slime, but it would have disturbed James. There was a shudder within the asteroid as it cracked, compressing down into a spear, and began to rotate at high speeds. As if feeling threatened, the slime began to move back in a hurry, its core rapidly shifting positions within its body. However, how was James going to let it go now that he had finished his epiphany? The Spear of Earth shot out, piercing into the body of the slime and passing through it without striking the core. As soon as it exited the slime's body, a portal appeared in front of it, teleporting it to a different corner of the body to continue the attack. In an instant, dozens of lights seemed to flash by, the spear constantly accelerating until it finally struck the silver core. The gaseous body of the slime shuddered, the black mist slowly fading away. James, meanwhile, looked around, allowing his spear to break apart. He no longer needed this asteroid cave, and instead had to find a larger area where he could perform experiments. He picked the nearest star and flew towards it at his fastest speed, his body constantly teleporting forward mid-flight. I need to find the proper formula to combine an advanced energy with two saint energies. Although this was only the first step of his salvation, it was a crucial step forward. When I saw James taking action, I thought he must have comprehended something, so I called Chelsea over to watch. Despite him having used a system sphere to get the game system for himself, he was still technically not part of my assets, so I couldn't read his mind. Neither could Chell, unless he was directing a prayer towards her. "What's he planning?" I asked, glancing over at the smaller kitsune. Chell shook her head, not having a proper answer. "Let me ask him," she said, before closing her eyes. When she opened them again, her eyes went wide. That could work. "Explanations, please?" "He's going to do a big combination energy, one that could result in a new saint energy. The theory is solid, and the fact that his karma kept trying to interrupt him implies that it could work. It's that energy that lets him see the past and potential future, the one light that Tsubaki is practicing, and the Eye of Ruin that lets him destroy anything he has fully analyzed." I furrowed my brow at that, trying to imagine the three energies working together. "So he wants to use the effects of the first two to analyze his karma, and then the Eye of Ruin to destroy his karma?" "No, it's not that simple. If he could just do that, he wouldn't need to combine them," Chell refuted, shaking her head quickly. "His hypothesis is that this combination of energies will allow him to weaponize karma to an even greater degree than one light. Rather than using his karma as a sword, he will use it as a consumable bullet. If he's right, he should be able to pour all of his negative karma into one attack and then fire it off into the distance. Once he does that, he won't have to deal with the negative karma himself anymore." My eyes went wide, doing my best to imagine that. "He can't do that inside of any world. He has to go to the void first. Otherwise, with his karma that comes from destroying multiple universes, that one bullet would probably be enough to destroy another universe." Chell pursed her lips, but nodded her head in agreement. "He should know that, too. Ideally, he would use that attack on a powerful enemy, such as your opponent in the next invasion. He won't do that, though, because the longer he waits to fire it, the longer he is unable to come back and help with planning the defense." "Yeah, I don't want him to wait either. In my opinion, the sooner James got back to his research facility, the better. I just want to ask, is there any potential risk of this karma bullet turning into a new void monster if he fires it off without a target?" Chell paused, thinking. As she did, her face gradually went pale.
It's possible, yes. The karma bullet would be full of the information about everything he had done until now. It's basically his life story. If it traveled long enough to be corroded by the void, it could turn into a corrupted void beast with his intelligence, one that lives to destroy more universes. When she said that, she jumped up again, pacing back and forth. "We can't just use a void beast as the target either. Even the strongest void beast wouldn't be able to absorb enough energy from the bullet before it was destroyed. The only way, we need to fire it at a world barrier, if the bullet pierced the barrier, it would have a theoretically infinite distance to travel and disperse naturally while the world broke down around it. But if he destroys another universe, we're back to square one.
Chell brought her hands up to tug at her hair, Tsubaki speaking up next to me.
What if it is a world with a modifier that does not allow life to grow? She asked, causing Chell and myself to both look over at her in surprise.
Right, right. If there's no life, there's no harm being done for his karma.
Chell nodded her head quickly, following Tsubaki's line of thought.
A world designed without life. That would probably be a rather niche modifier, but it wouldn't be a powerful one, so I imagine it would be cheap.
It wouldn't count as me resetting the world if I allowed it to willingly be destroyed, right? I asked, hesitantly. After the reveal of the Heaven's Gate, I knew that there were some perks to be had by reaching certain levels without resetting a world. Thankfully, Chell shook her head.
There's no reason why it would count. This isn't resetting a world because you won't get the points you spend back. This will be pure world destruction. But a normal world won't be enough. The world has to be strong enough that the karma can dissipate completely before it's destroyed. You'll need to buy at least a size 8 world. If it's bigger than that, the bullet might not be able to destroy it. Any smaller, and the karma won't dissipate before the world shatters. I nodded my head, letting out a sigh of relief.
Let him know the plan, then. Once he's ready to use this new power, I'll make a lifeless world for him to use as a target. At least there was something that I could do to help resolve this problem. Besides, the last thing that I wanted was to have to deal with a void beast modeled after James, with the sole desire to destroy every world I owned. That would be very bad.
I'll let him know closer to time, Chell said, falling back down on the couch. If he knows you have a plan now, there might be a bit of karma feedback from him acknowledging our help.
Right, that would be bad, I gulped, eyes going wide, and imagining a global malfunction like what the lab had to deal with.
Chell, on the other hand, couldn't help but smirk. Yeah, don't want to turn out like 350.
What? Did something happen to the lab again?
I looked over at Chell in shock, and even Tsubaki seemed concerned. He and Cyrus quit the Institute a few years back. Chell shrugged her shoulders. After that, Cyrus tried to join another research group and was using his spatial key for deliveries when something went wrong. His body made it through the jump, but his key didn't, effectively killing him. 350, on the other hand, was reassigned by the March to a research outpost on an uninhabited remote planet, trying to find a new method of void defense. Instead, he accidentally opened a void gate that swallowed the planet he was on.
You played karma tricks on them, didn't you? I asked, and Chell simply rolled her eyes.
System companions have to be protective of their keepers. James and I might not be in those roles anymore, but that hasn't changed.
Chapter 23. Now that James had found the path to resolve his crisis, it was only a matter of time until it could be handled. In that case, I went ahead to see which one of my timers it was that had been triggered to halt the fast-forward process. The void defense timer is still missing a couple of levels. Lifra is not in any immediate danger. No apocalyptic void entities have appeared, and there aren't any major crises at the moment. Ah! Once I found the timer, I quickly directed my attention at it, only to be disappointed. The timer that was resolved was the one to reach the 61st layer of Fior. As it turned out, someone had only just done this after 20 years of mass exploration. The reason that I was disappointed was the fact that they would not be able to return safely. I looked at the scene of the 61st floor, where faint red mist was scattering in front of the gate. Looking back through the records, I saw a Dova woman walk through the gate naturally, looking around in shock before her body suddenly began to dissolve. There didn't seem to be another entity attacking her, which led me to investigate the ambient energy of the floor. Sure enough, the entire 61st floor was shrouded with a dense, invisible energy. The moment that the Dova woman emerged through the portal, it immediately drained her of all of her ki, which caused her energy body to break down. As Chell hadn't left yet, I glanced over at her to get her opinion on the situation. Unsurprisingly, she had a rather troubled expression.
"This reminds me of the 26th floor."
"The crystal maze?" I blinked, before remembering. "You mean how it devoured those that had high mana levels?"
"That's right."
She nodded her agreement. "However, this effect is far more insidious, taking effect immediately and without regard for how much of the targeted energy one has. Any creature without the proper protection will be immediately killed the moment that they enter this floor, so long as they rely on ki in the slightest."
"So only eons and world spirits are safe?"
"But eons probably can't go without their summoner, given the situation with the preceding floor." As those thoughts flashed by, I furrowed my brow.
"Would gods be protected? They convert their ki with their divine energy, so it is no longer purely ki."
Chell shrugged her shoulders, unable to provide me with a solid answer.
"Without conducting tests, I won't know. However, it seems we got rather unfortunate with this lineup. The 60th floor can only be passed by relying on absolute luck for the first time, while the 61st floor will kill almost anyone that arrives before they can turn back.
Until someone survives long enough to retreat, this floor won't be open to the public, not unless you do something on your end."
Chell looked up at me, gauging my reaction. However, I simply shook my head.
"They'll soon know that the next floor is dangerous, though they won't know the exact nature of the danger. The fact that this one explorer won't be able to report for their regular pay will be enough to tip people off that they found the next floor. After all, the 60th floor has been guaranteed to be completely safe, so there is no reason for her to have died there."
Chell hesitated, lowering her head.
"The first thing that they will do is call together all explorers and make sure that none of them harmed her secretly. Although the floor itself is safe, there is still the possibility that people were involved. Maybe they will think that she stumbled upon a criminal act and the perpetrators silenced her."
"That's certainly a possibility," I admitted with a sigh. In fact, it was more likely that she was killed by other people than miraculously finding the entry point of the next floor.
"Still, I think it's a good idea to let them discover this for themselves. At most, it will delay the progress of Fior's exploration by a few more decades."
"In that case, what are you going to do next?"
Hearing that question, I crossed my arms in front of me, thinking. There were quite a few things that I could do to benefit myself. I had already comprehended both types of martial intent that I initially trained. But I could train in additional weapons, such as the sword or bow. I had become proficient with the three styles that I chose from the selection we purchased previously, though I was by no means a great master of them. My goals should be to either fully master the three styles I chose, obtain a new style unique to me as my trump card, or perhaps I can learn from Lifra in order to combine the styles that I possess. Up until now, I had created a total of 11 creatures from the Beasts of the End, though I had not obtained any practical experience with training them. Aside from the Shadow Hound I made with Dana, I think some of the others can be recycled. As I thought about that, an image came to my mind, causing my eyes to widen. "I'm going to train," I said as I stood up, blue light flashing around me. With a thought, I left behind a confused Chelsea and Tsubaki, descending to one of the training rooms in Olympus. "Athena, please patch in Vivi's training program. I think Tubrock should have given you access to it, correct?"
"That is correct, sir."
Athena's voice spoke up, before a holographic figure of a woman appeared before me, a surprised look on her face.
"Keeper, sir, I was not expecting this visit. Is there something that I can help you with?"
Vivi asked politely, her hands folding in front of herself. "I'm planning to retrain the Beasts of the End. I'll need your guidance along the way," I said, focusing on the brands in my soul. Aside from the Shadow Hound, I immediately destroyed the other 10 brands, cutting off my previous training of this technique. Vivi looked confused and more surprised than anything else.
"Sir, I believe you should be fully aware of how to cultivate your beasts at this point. Is there any need for me to guide you in this matter? I gave a small smile, nodding my head. I'm not making normal beasts this time. Let me show you first, and you'll see what I mean. As I said that, I sat cross-legged. I closed my eyes, bringing my hands together. Establish a seed. Visualize the concept. For this concept, strength, the power to crush everything in one's path, an unstoppable force. I could feel the seed forming in my hands, the concept taking root. Next was designing its appearance. Once that was done, I felt the egg responding, and so I threw it into the distance, Vivi watching curiously as the egg grew, larger and larger. Only when it was more than 20 meters tall did it shatter, revealing a bronze humanoid sitting cross-legged. The summon's hands were together, as if in prayer, and sprouting from its back were hundreds of tendril-like arms, spreading out in fan-shaped layers around it, each arm having a large hand at its end, like an ancient bodhisattva statue from my old world. Vivi still looked confused, but I was already standing. After all, this was the part where I had to subdue the summon in order to make it one of my beasts. Its eyes opened, and an aura of strength radiated from its body. Its main body didn't move, but its hands all spread out, as if trying to smash against me from all directions. I took a deep breath, assuming a familiar stance, and pressed my own palm forward as it began to radiate with ki. "Spirit-shattering," I muttered, a powerful wave of ki spreading forward and shredding the nearest arms. I took a half-step forward and thrust my hand out again, this time with my fingers curled inwards. Army-shattering. This time the ki spread in all directions, directly shattering the rest of the arms attached to the summon. At the same time, the first wave of power reached the summon's main body, smashing it against the wall. I focused, immediately forming the soul brand and placing it on the forehead of this creature. Once that was done, I unsummoned it and began making modifications to it. Vivi still looked like she didn't entirely understand what was going on, but that changed when the summon was released again. When I resummoned the statue-like figure, it once again radiated a powerful aura of strength, but this time it also contained its own aura of ki, adding a feeling of life to the bronze form. "You can't mean..." Vivi's eyes widened, and I had the statue demonstrate. One of its arms flew forward, fingers curled inwards to release the same army-shattering technique that I had just used. Seeing that my idea was possible, I turned to Vivi with a smile. "I want to create a beast for every style. It should be possible, right?" Vivi hesitated, but ultimately agreed on the concept. "If you create one beast for each of the styles uploaded into my program, aside from one of the beasts of the end itself, that will be a total of 9 summons. In that case, what do you want to do with your last beast?" My smile only grew wider at that. With a thought, blue threads began to emerge from my body, filling the air around me. "I still have one additional style that I can give to a beast." Vivi blinked, nodding quickly. "I see. However, you will need the beasts to perform individual training. Upon creation, they will only have the understanding of the style that you imbue them with. I suppose that's why. Your goal isn't to have me help you with creating these beasts directly, but lecturing you on the principles of the other styles." "That's right," I snapped my fingers, indicating that she had gotten it correct. "This is what the Keeper should be like. I embody all powers of the world. Each of my summons should represent one of these powers." With that said, I began to create the beasts that would be trained according to Vivi's teaching. The first was the absurdity of fate. For this, I imbued the concept of effect into a humanoid body, looking like a scholar with a longsword in one hand. He wore a light blue robe with a tall black hat. For the twin swords of joy and sorrow, I created a more colorful jester wielding twin scimitars. Its face was a masquerade mask, one half smiling while the other half cried. Its limbs were long and narrow, looking like something straight out of a nightmare. The concept that I gave to it was hope. Hope can bring joy when fulfilled, and endless sorrow when crushed. Next was the essence of the world's end. For this one I created a humanoid turtle, wrinkled with age and walking with the aid of a cudgel. Its appearance could make anyone underestimate the power that its art contained. The concept that I gave this summon was flow, controlling the movement of all things. The way of hidden truths was easy. For this one I created a stereotypical ninja figure, a mysterious humanoid wrapped from head to toe in black cloth, only a pair of softly glowing eyes peeking through. This one was given the concept of deception, for reasons I thought rather obvious. Following that was the heart of combat. This one turned out to be a bare-chested soldier wearing armor over his arms and lower body, his chest full of scars. In one hand, he held a sinister, serrated blade. Because of his theme, I gave him the concept of slaughter. Elemental embodiment broke away from the humanoid form, first appearing as a red crystal surrounded by inextinguishable fire. Its body would change into whatever form it wished to take with the element that it composed itself of. Similarly, the concept given to this one was change. Nature's wrath, in a way, was similar to elemental embodiment. At least the final technique was. This was what Lifra used against the boss monster previously, the embodiment of nature's wrath. Whereas elemental embodiment directly turns your body into elemental energy, nature's wrath allows you to control natural energy as if it were part of your own body. Thus, the entity I created for this one was a woman with short blue hair and silver eyes. Additionally, I empowered her with the concept of wrath. To finish off the new styles, there was Will of the World. This one allowed the user to set up prohibitions and boons by imbuing the natural world with their will. For instance, forbidding mana from exiting the body to create spells. Thus, I made the image of one who was most adept at creating rules in their favor. A man with well-combed hair and a suit, carrying a black briefcase. This was perhaps the most satisfying one to punch in the face, and I gave him the concept of law. Last but not least, 1,000 arms, 10,000 threads. This was my original style and the one that I was most proficient in. To embody this style, I created a woman with long flowing black hair in an Asian-style dress. To finish things off, I gave her the concept of tapestry. Once I had all of my summons created, it was time to get Vivi's help with training for those that I didn't know. After all, the only ones of these that I had trained myself were 12 Shattering Hands, Elemental Embodiment, and 1,000 Arms, 10,000 Threads. Thankfully, once I trained them in the basics, it shouldn't be a problem to have them train more advanced techniques on their own. Dana was living proof that a properly made Eon could learn, still train, without direct guidance. Chapter 24. After I finished creating my new Beasts of the End, I remained in the training room to receive the basic knowledge for each of the different martial arts that I wasn't familiar with. Although the summons could train themselves, I would need to know enough about the art to give them the aptitude for it. For instance, in order for my Beast of Strength to practice the 12 Shattering Hands, I needed to give it enough ki and shape that key into the proper pathways. Only once I had given each of them the fundamental requirements to practice their assigned arts did I increase their intelligence and willpower enough to allow them to train independently. At this point, they still consumed my mana to be summoned, but with my reserves, I was not worried that they would bleed me dry. When I was done getting everything set, I left the training room with most of the summons, leaving only the Beast of Strength behind. When I exited the room, I saw Tsubaki waiting for me, hands folded neatly in front of herself. She had a knowing smile on her face, and I assumed that she had watched me from the admin room before deciding to descend when she saw that I was almost done. I smiled at her, offering a small nod before directing the rest of the summons to their own training rooms. I'll be staying down here for a while, until they have all become proficient in their different techniques. I had assumed as much, my keeper. Tsubaki spoke in a soft tone, following me as I deposited each summon into their own training room.
For the time being, I wasn't focusing on giving them any overwhelming stats, because if I did, they might break the training rooms. It was easier to let them master the various styles and then start increasing their power. As I thought about that, I glanced over to Tsubaki. "By the way, when you were training with your avatars, did you learn the other styles yourself?" I asked, curiously. She had spent quite a while alone, and with all of her avatars training individually, I would not have put it past her. Surprisingly, though, she shook her head. "Only so much as to learn how to fight against them. In terms of mastery, I have reached the Avatar of War stage and Heart of Combat, and layered deception for the Way of Many Truths." I was not familiar enough with those styles to know what those titles represented. I simply nodded, leading Tsubaki back to the living room. For the time being, it seemed like I would need to stay descended.
"Boss!"
Dana's voice suddenly called out when we had just sat down, startling me and causing me to glance back. The small black-haired elf was staring at me from the doorway. "Yeah, Dana?"
"I want to train your summons," she shouted out, causing me to blink in confusion.
"Okay, but why?"
"Because I started as an eon, and now I finally get to train other intelligent eons."
Dana nodded her head, as if it should have been obvious. I had the feeling that there was more to it, but I wasn't going to press for an answer. If she really wanted to train them, then I didn't really have a reason to stop her.
"You're proficient with the absurdity of fate style, so you can start with that one. He's in my third training room. I'll have the rest go over to you when they're good enough with their own techniques."
Dana grinned wide, nodding her head and turning to run out of the living room.
"Okay, now I'm even more curious," I thought to myself. I'd have to figure out what she was up to later.
Lifra sat within a wooden office, leaning over her chair with a golden pen in one hand, writing away on a stack of papers. Every now and then she paused, thinking aloud to herself.
"What type of beast should the pirate queen tame to rule the endless sea?" she asked, one finger tapping against the wooden desk.
She closed her eyes, immersing herself in the role of her character. In a world where pirates roamed the endless seas, what beast would truly be the most terrifying to encounter? The old trope of a giant squid or octopus was somewhat overdone. The pirate queen wanted something new, something that would send a chill down the spines of her enemies. Her legs swung beneath her desk, happily thinking over the scenario to try to come up with a powerful monster to serve as the pirate queen's fierce beast. Soon the door of the office swung open, a Hirok woman standing in the doorway.
"Captain, we've got land to starboard," the Hirok announced, Lifra's eyes going wide.
She reached over, grabbing a black hat and throwing it on her head before she marched out of the room. When she emerged, she stood on the deck of a great wooden ship, over 1,000 meters long. The sails of the ship were woven from a silvery metal with a hexagonal pattern, while golden ripples spread like gentle waves on either side of the ship. Lifra walked to the right side of the ship, the starboard, and gazed out into the darkness. This was a ship flying the true endless sea, the Sea of Stars. Off in the distance, Lifra could make out a green planet, resting in the emptiness like a priceless gem.
"Send out a search party,"
Lifra shouted back to her crew, more than 12 people heading for a small ship at the side of this larger vessel. When they dropped from the main ship, runic patterns lit up along their hull, and golden ripples began to spread for them as well. Their speed was considerable, sailing into the distance and becoming little more than a golden trail leading to the planet.
"Captain," the Hirok from earlier shouted, "we've got trouble at the stern."
Lifra blinked in surprise, turning and running along the deck of her ship, rushing towards the rear. As she ran, she caught sight of an elongated mass stretching towards her from the darkness. Her tongue clicked, jumping onto the railing at the very back of the ship to get a better look.
"Aye, it seems we've found our mark."
Stretching towards her was a black mass that resembled a massive hand, attached to an arm that seemed to extend to nowhere. Lifra could make out glowing spots like starlight on the hand, and knew immediately what she was looking at.
"Soraya,"
she called out, a hand extended to her side. The Hirok nodded her head, walking over and placing a hand in Lifra's. The moment she did,
her entire figure distorted and shrank, turning into a black pistol in Lifra's hand.
"I told you we should have prepared cannons, Captain," a voice spoke up from the pistol, but Lifra simply laughed.
"What do I need a cannon for?" she shouted, pointing the pistol towards the hand.
Its fingers had almost reached the ship, and the invisible barrier around them shuddered. Lifra's eyes slowly began to shine, piercing the darkness of space. She looked out beyond the starry sky as if she could see the source of the hand beyond.
"This is my story. You're not welcome in it," she said, pulling the trigger.
Immediately a golden line stretched out from the pistol, piercing into the hand like a spear. Although the mark left by this pistol was minuscule compared to the overall size of the hand itself, it froze the moment the golden light touched it. Lifra's gaze remained focused on the entity she saw beyond the sky, smiling to herself as she saw it scream in pain, recoiling back. It wasn't dead, but its cry had triggered the alarm within the void barrier. Lifra could already see three fallen gods rushing over to investigate. Nodding in satisfaction, she tossed the pistol behind her, and it warped once again to become the Hirok she had been speaking with until now.
"Take a breather, Saraya. I'll call you again if I need you."
"I'm sure you will, Captain."
The Hirok rolled her eyes, her body melting down into the frame of the ship. Lifra knew that she would be able to call her at a moment's notice, but simply took her time to walk back to the bow. Behind her, the massive hand melted into the emptiness of space, its main body having more important things to focus on. By the time that she arrived at the bow, she could see the dinghy she set out making its return trip. Her brow furrowed, lips pursed. She changed her course to greet them as they returned, already sure that she knew what they had to report.
"Captain,"
the halfling girl shouted, jumping up to the deck of the ship.
"It's the same as the others. Though there are signs of a low-level civilization, it has been eradicated by the beasts."
Lifra let out a faint sigh, nodding her head.
"Any new recruits?"
The halfling dismissed the hopeful thought immediately, however.
"Any poor soul that remained through the collapse of civilization has long been sent to Irena's grasp."
"As it should be. They've earned their retirement. In that case, Lena, set a course for where the stars may take us. There are many a beast hidden among the endless sea of stars. We've yet more to tell for this adventure."
"Yes, Captain," Lena nodded, and the sail of the ship turned, catching the light of the nearest star.
"All crew, brace for stormy weather. We sail by the light of the stars."
Several crew members reached out for the nearest wall or railing to brace themselves as the surroundings became a dark blur, the ship flying out of the solar system. Every now and then a white streak passed by, gone in a single blink.
"Have you decided on a combat form yet, Lena?"
Lifra asked, looking over at the halfling, who simply shook her head.
"Not yet, Captain. You know I'm not one for fighting. I'll serve as your eyes for as long as you'll have me."
She responded with a smile, causing Lifra to smack the back of her head.
"I've got eyes of my own," she scolded, though she had a small grin on her face. "If you want to focus on being the navigator, I'll support you, but every soul aboard this vessel must be able to play a part if danger comes. If you don't want to attack, then don't. Become a shield for your friends."
Lena blinked at that, thinking while rubbing the back of her head.
I think I get it. All right, I've got an idea for my combat form. Can you have Sasha take over while I work on it?"
Lifra nodded her head with a faint smile.
"Go, let me see what our star navigator can come up with."
Lena quickly ran below the deck, and Lifra walked back to her cabin with her hands behind her back.
"Sasha, the helm is yours. Steady the course and keep your eyes peeled for traces of the beasts," she called out,
a pale human rising from the deck.
"Yes, Captain," she said,
walking towards the ship's wheel, which seemed to be turning on its own. Lifra hummed a merry tune to herself as she entered her cabin, looking at the nameplate of the ship in her office. The Last Gasp was a ship that she had spent more than a year writing, consulting various shipwrights and veteran explorers. Once she had finished writing the tale of the ship, she used her divinity to bring it into reality. The Last Gasp had no need for a living crew, being the very epitome of a ghost ship. Only souls were allowed to crew the vessel, with the exception of the ship's captain. Though Lyphra herself was only a temporary captain until she finished writing the story of the one who would take over for her. As for why those on the ship could turn into weapons, Lyphra had taken a look at an old technique in the Keeper's library and adapted it to fit her ship. Originally, Akiseppo was a technique which required unwavering trust between two individuals. After studying the technique, Lyphra adapted it so that the crew need only have such trust in the ship to which they were bound, and the captain acted as the living avatar of the ship. Closing her eyes with a sigh, Lyphra sat down at her desk again, reaching for her pen. Suddenly, her eyes opened wide, a bright smile coming across her face. "A demigod dragon of order," she called out, as inspiration struck her, quickly putting pen to paper. "When it's not active, it can serve as the figurehead of the ship, coming to life at the Queen's call. Those who disobey the Queen's order will face the wrath of her dragon." Chapter 25. Elise stood atop the highest tower of her castle, thinking to herself while gazing into the dark horizon. The nation of Hanby had changed considerably over the years, both with their technological advancements and its political relationships. As it stood, Hanby now almost dominated the human continent. While Elise had not always intended this result to happen, she ultimately felt that it was inevitable. After all, Hanby was stronger both technologically and economically, and was one of the few nations that had a goddess presiding over it. In the last few years, Hanby had begun to integrate with other nations, absorbing their land and expanding their own borders. The main reason why such a thing was possible was the living conditions in Hanby, which could be considered the best in all of Earth. Whether it was their education, law enforcement, or agriculture, the residents of Hanby were able to develop in a safe environment without sacrificing their personal growth. Although it seemed silly to think that a video game was the turning point of the nation's political landscape, it was true. Hanby had frequent patrols that eliminated the dangerous monsters within its borders, which left the lower-level civilians unable to obtain experience fighting. This was why nobody originally considered submitting to Hanby, because they were looking towards the future. If Hanby's newer generation was unable to obtain experience, they were destined to decline. The way that Elise solved this was rather unique. She found an entire empire within fragments of Assyria and dedicated it to the people of Hanby. This provided her civilians with more than enough room to develop in a safe environment, where their personal training would synchronize with the real world. Over time, Elise began to approach the leaders of neighboring countries. She would propose to protect the other party's nation by expanding their more advanced policies, in exchange for the other nation coming under their banner. At the same time, the current ruler would be allowed to maintain their control over the local territory as a governor, so long as they were not involved in any corrupt practices. Originally, many nations rejected this idea, feeling that Elise was making a grab for power. Elise did not take these rejections to heart, feeling that it was only natural. She even took steps to ensure that the rejection did not impart any negative karma on the other party. Although she couldn't say that she could fully control her karma, she had certainly learned more rules in regards to how it functioned. For those few countries that did join at first, they experienced a surprising period of growth. This was not only because of fragments of Assyria, or the beneficial policies, but also because they had come under the banner of the goddess of wishes, honesty, and peace. Yes, she had acquired two additional domains, one by divine forging, and the other as a fragment from the game. Unlike most divine rulers, Elise focused all of her divine abilities towards the protection and development of her country. After a few years of watching and observing the situation, several countries attempted to renegotiate with Elise. They wanted her protection without admitting Hanby as their sovereign. Unfortunately for them, Elise had to firmly reject this proposal, because her abilities had been set such that they only worked passively within the borders of Hanby itself. Thus, expanding these powers to other nations could only be done when they accepted themselves as part of Hanby.
Over time, more countries decided to accept the proposals, some even actively reaching out to Elise. After all, she did not truly ask for them to do anything other than recognize Hanby as their ruling power. She wasn't asking to tax them or for any other special resources. All trade would continue as it had before. The only thing being changed was that the kings and queens of these nations now had another person to answer to if anything extreme happened. Now, there was only one nation left that vehemently opposed the integration of Hanby's policies. That country was none other than Cross, still under the command of the King of Knights, Reynard Cross himself. Reynard Cross often portrayed his nation as the original divine nation of humans, having ruled as a god long before even Udana took the throne. At the same time, he painted Hanby as a wicked dictatorship in order to push his warlike policies. As a stark contrast to Hanby, many citizens of Cross were suffering under unfair taxation, the brutality of law enforcement, or even the inability to protect themselves from local monsters. Elise had tried to reason with Reynard, proposing a number of measures to lessen the hardships of civilians, but she was refused every time. She was confident that the only reason Reynard never attacked her directly was for fear of her karma. Thus, with her being unable to help openly, she arranged more secretive methods of helping the citizens of Cross. She sent out covert teams, offering those most affected sanctuary and a better life. For those that agreed, they fabricated a scene of a monster attack in order to discreetly take them under Hanby's care. Naturally, this had led to a decline of Cross's population, but Reynard still showed no signs of compromise. He spoke to his nation as if Cross was thriving, as if there was no land more powerful. Elise could only shake her head and sigh, wondering if Reynard had truly lost his mind. "What else can I do?" she asked herself. Hanby had already become a true empire, appearing as the face of the human race on Earth. However, looking at the situation in Cross, she always felt that there was more that she should be doing. It was hard for her not to resent the fact that people were suffering when there was no need for them to do so. She let out a long sigh, holding one hand to the night sky and muttering to herself, "This wish I make on behalf of those under my care. I wish for the knowledge to save those suffering under tyranny, to save those who lack the means to save themselves." A golden ring appeared around her wrist as she spoke, and Elise felt a familiar rush of knowledge. In fact, she made this wish every year, hoping for a different answer. Every year her divinity advised her to go to war, to forcibly annex Cross. In doing so, there would be a brief period of bloodshed, followed by the unification of the continent. Elise despised this answer. Saving the people of Cross by killing her way into the capital? That was unacceptable. If a war truly broke out, knowing Reynard's personality, he would conscript every able-bodied man and woman to fight. No matter how conservatively she fought, there would be far too many sacrifices. Thus, she sighed, preparing to lower her hand. As she did, a new surge of information began to enter her mind, different from the usual urging of war. She saw a massive spell diagram and felt the knowledge of its purpose, a special energy, one that she had never heard of before. Elise didn't know why she was getting this information now, when she had never received it in recent decades. However, this energy provided a new hope for her. If she could successfully create the energy depicted in her vision, it would help Hanby in ways she had never expected. Unfortunately, Elise was not well-versed in such high-tier magic. She had no confidence in casting this spell herself, so she was troubled. She sat down on the tower and pulled out her terminal, activating a modeling software and beginning to record the spell that appeared in her mind. In total, it took Elise more than 12 hours of constant work before the spell was fully transcribed. When it was, she felt as if the information had vanished from her mind. Although she could still recall the vision, she no longer saw the spell in as much detail as before, as if her divinity had merely been holding on to it long enough for her to record it down. "I need to speak with someone about this," she muttered to herself, closing her eyes. "Lady Janice, are you free to speak?" Across the vast sea, the sun was only just rising,
and the Queen of Gandor felt the familiar voice entering her mind. With a smile, she closed her eyes.
This is a rare treat for the rising Empress to seek me out.
Please don't tease me, Lady Janice. I wish to seek your aid in a critical matter.
When the Queen heard that, her brow raised slightly. There was something that Elise needed to consult with her about?
Have you set your eyes on even the land of Gandor? She responded, though there was still a touch of a playful tone.
In truth, she wasn't sure if Elise planned to turn her attention to other continents after she finished unifying the human realms.
Surely not, Elise responded swiftly. My divinity provided me with a spell in response to a wish. However, I don't have the expertise to cast such a complicated spell. It is of the fourth tier, and should be among the more complicated ones in the tier.
The Elven Queen was confused, understandably.
It must be the dead of night for you. You called at such a time merely to ask for the use of a scroll printer.
Scroll printers weren't incredibly complicated devices, though they were a specialty of Gandor, especially those for fourth-tier spells.
More than that, I would appreciate it if you analyzed the spell and gave me your thoughts on it. I do not know how useful it will be to you, but I trust your judgment when it comes to magic.
The Elven Queen hesitated, but ultimately let out a sigh. In the end, she was being asked to proofread the spell. This showed that Elise trusted her with the matter, but at the same time, it was a strange request to give to the ruler of another nation.
I'll take a look at it. I hope that this spell won't prove to be a waste of time, she scolded lightly, indicating that Elise should have given the matter of proofreading the spell to her own scholars.
Thank you, Lady Janice. I'm sending a model of the spell to you now.
The Elven Queen shook her head, retrieving her own terminal. When she saw the complex spell model, she thought little of it, passing it through a geometric translation software. There were bound to be some small flaws in the model, which were smoothed out by the translation. Roughly 15 minutes later, when the spell had been fully translated, the Elven Queen looked at the printout of the spell's effects.
It's clearly meant to create an advanced energy, she thought to herself, seeing the step-by-step instructions for the energy conversion. However, she had no means of telling what energy would be created by the spell. Unlike Elise, the Elven Queen was not a god queen. She had ruled for centuries by virtue of her elven lineage. Meanwhile, this spell seemed to require a touch of divinity to use properly. Why couldn't she send this request to someone else? Even the Ashtanu Research Foundation would be more equipped than myself.
As the Queen thought of this, she thought back to Elise's special circumstances. Something about her karma directed her to send this to her rather than anyone else.
Is she offering me a chance? Everyone knows that helping Elise is equivalent to helping yourself.
In the end, there was only one thing that she could do. She had to make sure that the spell worked. But she did not possess the divinity needed to use it herself. In that case, she sent a message out to summon her grandson, a recently awakened god of magic. When her son entered the throne room, he gave a polite bow. Despite his divinity, he still showed the proper respect for his grandmother as the ruler of the nation.
Your Highness.
Gelwyn, I would like you to test the safety of a spell for me. This spell comes from the human empress, so I expect that there will not be any problems, but it requires divinity to use. Thus, I can only entrust this matter to you.
Gelwyn blinked in surprise, having the same thoughts as the Queen herself when he heard that Elise asked them to review a spell.
In that case, I can only act according to your Highness's wishes, he said, in that same polite tone.
The Queen made a gesture at her terminal, and soon Gelwyn's own terminal released a soft hum.
If there are no problems, you can perform the spell immediately.
Gelwyn thought about that, looking through the file that he had been sent. As a god of magic, it was easy for him to analyze and save even a fourth-tier spell to his mind. After looking at it for roughly a minute, he closed the file and turned around, extending his hand. His divinity and mana poured out, creating the same magic diagram that was depicted in the file. With how densely woven the lines of the diagram were, the Queen was able to see nothing other than flowing silver and green energy rushing towards the spell. Meanwhile, Gelwyn maintained a calm expression, watching as the spell merged the various energies together. In the end, a small trace of his divinity was extracted for the spell. When the spell was completed, a golden crystal hovered in the air, floating over to melt into his chest. Gelwyn closed his eyes, sensing this energy.
The energy appears to be stable, and it doesn't show any signs of any adverse reaction. You should be able to tell the human empress that there is nothing wrong with the spell itself. Additionally, I was awarded an achievement for the successful creation of a saint energy.
The queen offered a small sigh of relief, closing her eyes again to send a message to Elise.
I have reviewed the spell, and it appears to make an energy that takes the form of a golden crystal. I can have a scroll of this spell sent to you, though I would like to ask what the purpose of this energy is. Thankfully, Elise seemed to have no desire to hide the truth, though that was also one of her pledges as the goddess of honesty.
This is an energy designed for divine rulers. Think of it like a cross between the priest and maid class, kind of. Someone that has this energy can imprint their divine abilities in it and impart a seed of it to someone else, designating them as their follower. Their followers, in turn, can use those divine abilities themselves while enriching their own divinity. Once their divinity has reached a certain threshold, they can impart a seed of this energy themselves unto others, further sharing the original abilities. Meanwhile, any god that has access to this energy from the same source can impart their own divine abilities, creating a network of divine power. Most importantly, because this energy only replicates divine abilities that have been saved, it doesn't pose a risk of collapsing if too many different divinities are incorporated. The downside is that the gods who have this energy can't access the powers saved by other gods.
The elven queen furrowed her brow, as if wondering what the point was, before she blinked in realization.
You mean this energy purely exists for mortals serving the divine?
That's right. Because it nurtures their divinity, these mortals will be able to use the replicated divine powers if an urgent need arises, Elise confirmed readily. I call it the gift of divine rule.
Chapter 26.
Elise only had to wait a few hours until the sun began to rise in the morning. After that, an elven messenger arrived, bringing with him a rolled-up scroll. Offering a smile, she thanked him for the speedy delivery. Receiving her thanks, the messenger looked almost ecstatic, because everyone knew what it meant to do a favor for her, even if she did not directly pay them. He quickly left the palace, leaving Elise with the scroll that had been sent to her. Like Gelwyn, she immediately activated the magic within the scroll, observing the intricate diagram that appeared in the air within her throne room. Elise closed her eyes, feeling how her energy was being pulled to facilitate the spell. Once the spell was complete, Elise saw the same golden crystal floating over to her. With a smile, she allowed it to sink into her chest. Now, it was just a matter of determining what divine powers she wanted to imbue into the energy. Alice Whiteburn rubbed the sweat from her brow as she sat at a corner of her field, baked beneath the heavy sun. She wore a wide-brimmed straw hat to offer herself just a little bit of shade, and wore denim overalls over a green shirt. In her hand was a curved sickle, the blade etched with runic markings.
"Ready for the harvest?" a young man asked as he walked over, Alice nodding her head while keeping her eyes focused.
Natural energy was being funneled into the field, stimulating the growth of the plants.
You know, you could always just move to a lauric plantation. There aren't many farmers left that don't use the new system there, right?
Alice hesitated, but ultimately shook her head.
The system's fine and all, but I don't want to lose my time like that. I got friends on this side, and going there means cutting them off.
The man pursed his lips, but nodded his head. While people from Lorik and Spica could still communicate with those of other worlds, the time dilation made keeping in touch with friends difficult, to say the least. For every day that passed on Earth, nearly 3 weeks went by over there. So if you wanted to spend time with your friends once a week, the truth was that you weren't seeing them for more than 4 months on Lorik. The existence of virtual reality helped, in a way.
allowing people to synchronize with their virtual selves to obtain their memories. But even that was affected by the time shift. After all, it would only be a little more than an hour of virtual activity every day if your virtual self was on a server in a different world. For those farmers that still worked on Earth, Keown, or similar worlds, this was the main reason why they hadn't left. Their jobs had become less efficient, but they did not want to simply leave behind their current social lives. As the man was thinking about that, he saw Alice suddenly stand up, swinging her sickle. Three green lines stretched out from the blade, slicing into the air between the rows of crops. He heard a hiss and then the sound of something falling to the ground. There were always pests that tried to take advantage of the harvest time. Most of them were dealt with by the carnivorous plants that lined the edge of the field, but a few had concealment abilities that allowed them to get through. That was why every day Alice would sit at the field, ready to intercept the beasts, aiming to take the day's harvest. When the young man heard the creatures falling, he smiled, walking into the field. "I'll handle the collection for today. You go wash up, and I'll have dinner ready soon." Alice hesitated, but soon nodded her head with a small smile. "Thanks. I'll plant the next batch after we eat, then." To ensure that farmers like Alice were able to continue making a living, there was a tacit understanding between the farming communities of the worlds within the time dilation. Lorik and Spica would not trade fast-growing crops to the other worlds. Anything that a skilled farmer could grow in a week or less fell under this designation and became the primary crop that farmers on Earth and similar worlds began to grow and sell. Although there were exceptions, such as people putting such crops on the Boundless Caravan, the prices were typically kept to a point where farmers would be able to maintain a decent standard of living. Alice folded up her chair, putting it and the sickle in her inventory before walking back towards her house. She was just about to enter when her brow furrowed and the sickle appeared in her hand again. With firm steps, she walked to the front of the house, where a woman in smooth robes stood, holding a white staff with golden etching. "Something I can help you with?" Alice asked, eyes narrowed. She could sense the divinity from the woman, though she didn't know why she was here. Perhaps she wasn't a goddess herself, but a high-ranking priestess. Or maybe she was on her path of godhood. Regardless, if she was a local, there was little chance that she was here to make friends. "You can be at ease," the robed woman said, feeling the hostility from Alice. "I come from Hanby. I am part of the relief force sent by the Empress. You may address me as Ellie." "Hanby?" Alice's eyes narrowed a bit further, glancing around. She even raised her voice slightly in case anyone was listening. "I told the last of your lot that came here that I wasn't leaving." Ellie chuckled, shaking her head. "Don't worry. Nobody is eavesdropping. My staff blocks out perception beyond 20 meters. It's how I was able to make it this far." Alice nodded her head, her voice lowering again. "Anyways, my mind's not changed. I've not the means to move, nor any guarantee that I'd be safe there. You must know that the farms are monitored." Ellie let out a sigh, nodding her head. Due to the growing scarcity of farmers on Earth, Cross was very protective of their farmers. Or at least they called it being protective. If normal citizens were to take the offer to leave and join Hanby, that was one thing. Cross couldn't easily monitor anyone wanting to start a new life. Farmers were more rare, and thus easier to track. If a farm disappeared from Cross and then suddenly appeared in Hanby, they'd know what was going on, even if the farmer changed their appearance. "I'm aware," Ellie said, regretfully. "I won't ask you to move if you don't want to trouble your friends. I completely understand that. However, I would like to make you a different offer, if you would hear me out." "You've got 5 minutes," Alice said, in a strict tone. "Mason's gathering the crops, and he could be back after that."
5 minutes? Ellie blinked, before quickly nodding her head. "I'll make this brief, then. I am a priestess of the Empress. Recently, she has created a new method to offer protection to those unable to leave Cross's borders for one reason or another. This protection will not implicate you or require you to pledge any sort of allegiance. Seeing the increasingly curious look on Alice's face, Ellie continued. I contain a seed of energy in my body, provided by the Empress. If I grant this seed to you, you will be able to use a number of wishes in your time of need. Specifically, there are three that I think would be of benefit to you as a farmer. The first is to wish for prosperity. This will allow your farm to temporarily gain the effects of a farm from Lorik. I understand that this may raise questions when it comes to taxation, which is where the second wish comes in. The second wish is to wish for trade. The Empress has reached an agreement with the Boundless Caravan, allowing this wish to open the caravan to list items for sale. You won't be able to buy additional goods, but you will be able to collect your earnings if your produce sells. The third wish is only meant to be used in a dire circumstance, and that is the wish for protection. Using this wish will generate a barrier around you. The duration of the barrier will depend on how much you have cultivated the energy. However, if you make the wish a second time before the barrier is dispelled, you will immediately be teleported to a reception area within Hanby's borders, designed to receive refugees. Alice blinked, nodding her head slightly. So if I'm attacked by a monster, the first protection can stop it. But if it's a soldier, the second will get me away. Ellie's smile grew wider, and she readily agreed. That's correct. We don't want to force anyone to Hanby. Instead, we merely want to offer them the chance for a better life. Still, Alice was skeptical. And what's the price to get this energy or the method to cultivate it? Ellie let out a faint chuckle. There is no price. If you agree, I will immediately bestow the seed of power upon you. As for the cultivation method, that is even simpler. This energy works together with your own natural spark of divinity. In short, the more you believe in the energy, the more it will cultivate itself. We believe that the stimulation of your divine spark may even offer you the chance to walk your own path of divinity, once you have nurtured it enough. Alice's eyes widened. She had a hard time believing that there was anything this good to be so freely offered. In the back of her mind, she began to look for any strings or conditions that could be hidden within the offer. This doesn't exactly seem like a profitable business for your end. Ellie shook her head, leaning against her staff. We don't need your profits, frankly. In serving the Empress, we are blessed with a part of her fortune. If I am hungry, I can easily find sustenance in the wild. If I am in danger, I can find protection. If I am troubled, the answer will reveal itself to me in time. In exchange, the Empress has passed one simple edict to her following. We are to help those in need and ask nothing in return. A real religious charity? Alice smirked bitterly, but ultimately nodded her head. I'll take this help, then, and pray that I don't need to use it. Ellie nodded happily, reaching up and pinching slightly in front of her chest. A golden pebble emerged from her robes, and she held her hand out to pass it to Alice. Merely hold this against your chest, and you will obtain this seed of energy. Alice hesitated briefly before accepting the energy and doing as she had been instructed. She closed her eyes, feeling the small ball of energy sinking into her chest, and then nothing. She couldn't feel anything different about herself after it had entered her body. Everything okay, Alice? A young man's voice called out, and he walked over from behind the house. Clearly, he had already finished the collection and was getting ready to start preparing dinner. Alice's eyes shot wide open, worried that he would find the priestess. However, Ellie was no longer in front of her, having vanished while her eyes were shut. Huh? Oh, sorry. I thought I sensed something out here, so I wanted to make sure that there weren't any problems. A stray monster? Mason's eyes narrowed, and a sword appeared in one hand. Head inside, Alice. I'll check the area. Alice let out a faint sigh, nodding her head and turning to enter the house. Although he was often amiable, Mason was still a soldier of the kingdom. That was why he sometimes probed how she felt about leaving the kingdom. Worse, he worshipped Irena, so she couldn't even lie to him without being seen through. She had to be careful with her words, ensuring that she did not give any direct falsehoods. Thankfully, if what Ellie said about her fortune was true, Alice felt that she didn't need to worry for the priestess's safety. She just needed to let nature run its course, and Mason would return empty-handed. Chapter 27.
LSA had a relieved smile on her face when she felt the spread of her new energy. As long as she could improve the lives of the people of Cross, she wasn't really that interested in taking their land. After all, unlike other kingdoms, Cross had been quite resolute in their refusal. Without overthrowing and likely killing the King of Knights, there was no real way to absorb the land as she had done with the other nations. However, at the same time, she knew that such a conflict would be inevitable. The fact that she was spreading her energy to all that would accept it now was merely a prelude to prevent the wanton destruction that she had foreseen previously. The more people that inherited her energy, the fewer would be pulled into the battlefield when the time came. Hopefully, it will be reduced to just Cross and his knights, though that is rather optimistic, even for me. LSA knew that there would still be sacrifices, that no matter what course of action she took, she could not avoid this conflict.
Finally! James rolled his shoulders as he landed on a planet, looking at the wasteland surrounding him.
It's not ideal, but what could I expect from my circumstances? Thankfully, all James really